Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
First Friday of the month, everybody. You know what that means? Jobs to get us going today. Then the memory of Nelson Mandela and the victims of Bernie Madoff 5 years later. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 6th of December. Great, as always, to have you with us, gang. Without putting too fine a point on it, today was a pretty good day in the life of the American economy. We learned this morning 203,000 people found work last month and that the unemployment rate tumbled to 7%, even a number that has not been seen in five long years. And we will start there as we review the week that was. Heidi Moore from The Guardian is in New York. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal is down in Washington. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Heidi, find me the downside, would you? Don't tell me how good it was. Tell me how bad this number is.
You know I'm all over that.
I know.
It's bad for a few reasons. The drop in the unemployment rate is happening for all the wrong reasons, and that's what you should remember. We have fewer people than ever participating in the U.S. workforce. Mm-hmm. We have millions of people looking for jobs or taking part-time jobs because there's nothing else open to them. The one bright spot is that there are job gains in all sorts of sectors. But otherwise, this is a really unhappy report.
Sudeep, your turn.
I agree with Heidi that there are a lot of things to be unhappy about in this report. There are 11 million people who are still mm-hmm. officially jobless, mm-hmm. millions and millions more who are unofficially jobless. There's a lot of pain out there. It's an enormous human tragedy. People who are probably never going to find work again while we all celebrate stronger job growth and record after record in the stock market. But it is also indisputable that the job market is certainly improving. There is a reason we can say that things are better than they were in 2008. And so it is improvement, no matter how slow it's been. It's just obviously disappointing improvement.
Right. Which gets us to point number two for this afternoon's discussion, Heidi. What this number will mean come the Federal Reserve's meeting on the 17th and 18th and the taper and withdrawal of the stimulus and all of that.
Yeah, a lot of people at the high end of finance, economists and so on, are thinking about what the taper means, the stimulus that the Federal Reserve has put into right. place for the past 4 years. What happens when it goes? And people are expecting that if the jobs number, the unemployment rate keeps dropping, yep. that the Fed will pull its stimulus. And I don't think those fears are justified. The Fed is looking at far more than just the employment rate.
You don't think the taper's coming?
Not soon,
wow.
not this month,
wow.
and not for a few months. The Fed would be insane to look at this economy and say, hey, it's great. Let's take our stimulus away.
All right. I don't know if I buy that. Sudeep, what do you think?
I don't really buy that either yeah. because it is true that the economy is not taking off the way Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen would like it to be taking off. They are making this decision. They are worried about what's under the surface, but they are also worried about the risks that are being created when you have the stock market running up 30% of a year in a year for reasons that aren't entirely understandable, when you have all sorts of financial dislocations in markets because people are pouring their money in because they don't know what to do with it with record low interest rates. And so they are worried about that and worried about creating the next bubble, because we know that the Fed has contributed at least to bubbles before, and we don't know whether this is actually a bubble, but it's certainly a little bit fishy what we're seeing in markets, and they don't want to look back and say they wish they did something earlier to prevent that.
Right, and just look at the market today.
Here's the quick counterargument.
Yeah, go ahead, quick.
The quick counterargument is that Janet Yellen, who's the new Fed chair, yep. cares more about unemployment than stock market bubbles, and she's in favor of QE, so that's the argument for it sticking around.
Quantitative easing the stimulus. Yeah, but you know, you look at the markets today, Heidi, right? The Dow was up 200 points after being down all week on fears that the taper was coming. And now this number comes out today, which is a good number. The taper is going to come sooner rather than later. I'm sorry. I know you don't believe that. And now the Dow's up 200. What?
the market lies, right? That's the one thing that we've learned from the past 4 years. If you trust the market, you'll go insane. It's no indication of how well we're doing as a country or as an economy.
All right, fair enough. Sudeep, really quickly, Nancy Marshall-Genzer is going to be along in about 45 seconds to talk about Washington and the economy and jobs. But how badly can Washington in January and February mess up for us what seems to be a promising job market and economic recovery?
They could mess it up really badly. It's looking like they won't mess it up all that badly. And if you look back to where we were a year ago, we were facing a fiscal cliff, a sequester, a debt ceiling fight, all these other issues. And we got through it somehow. Oof. And it doesn't look like the issues that are coming up are going to be as bad as the ones we faced before.
Fingers crossed, baby. Fingers crossed. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal down in Washington. Heidi Moore from The Guardian. She is in our bureau in New York City. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll see you. Have a good weekend. As I said, we're going to talk about Washington jobs and the economy in a minute, so here we are. Come the end of the year, about 1.3 million people are going to see long-term unemployment benefits run out. And Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports that that number, on top of the day's jobs figures, is complicating the already complicated talks over the federal budget.
The federal unemployment benefits Congress is haggling over were meant to be temporary, but have been extended repeatedly. The latest extension runs out December 28th. If Congress allows it to expire, more than a million unemployed workers will lose their benefits almost immediately.
If we allow these extensions to expire, it's going to cause a lot more pain for Americans.
That's Elise Gould. She's an economist at the Economic Policy Institute. She says the whole economy would take a hit if the unemployment benefits weren't extended because unemployment checks are spent right away. Economist Robert Reischauer is a former head of the Congressional Budget Office.
The money comes in and it goes out very rapidly for food, clothing, gas for the car, and so on.
The White House says without that spending, 240,000 jobs will be lost next year. Reischauer says nobody wants that, and he thinks Congress realizes the economic recovery has been slower than usual, so people still need unemployment benefits. Douglas Holtz Aiken is also a former Congressional Budget Office director and economic advisor for Senator John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. He says,
when push comes to shove, saying I'm not willing to fund the unemployment insurance for those who've been out of work for 2 years, pretty tough vote to take.
And as Robert Reischauer puts it,
They certainly don't want to be Scrooge in the middle of a holiday season.
Because tales of the hardships of those denied benefits could haunt re-election campaigns like the ghost of Christmas past. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Traders took one look at that jobs number this morning, and it was off to the races, baby. I don't get to decide, but my guess is it's going to be the really happy music when we get there. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Both President Obama and his predecessor, George W. Bush, will go to South Africa next week to remember Nelson Mandela. Much of that country and the world is still mourning Mandela's passing and celebrating his legacy. Buntu Williams is a BBC business reporter in Johannesburg. Buntu, it's good to speak with you.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Everybody knows, I imagine, Nelson Mandela's legacy on the politics of South Africa. If you had to pick one or two things economically that he might be known for, what would they be?
I think he began a process that saw South Africa achieve the longest period of economic growth in its history, 15 years. I mean, from when it took over to 2008, when the global financial meltdown basically undermined all of those efforts. Mm. And besides that, most of the policies that would follow were really developed in the time that he was president.
It's interesting, though, because South Africa is still one of the most unequal societies in the world, right? I mean, income inequality and wage inequality and all of that is still very prevalent there.
Yeah, it's quite a problem, actually. Although there were policies that were supposed to stimulate the economy, they were just not creating jobs. There wasn't enough money. You must remember that when Mandela came into power, South Africa had around 10 days' worth of foreign reserves. South Africa was a pariah state, so which meant that there was no investment, and companies were not geared to be able to achieve such ambitious policies.
Did you say 10 days of foreign reserves when Mandela came to power? That's amazing.
Yes, exactly that. And right now we have around $50 billion in reserves. Yeah. I think that's good for about 3 months.
When Mandela came out of jail, it was a very different country, you know, and he went in with, it's widely been acknowledged, somewhat leftist political views. And he came out and he insisted on free markets. He didn't nationalize the mines. I mean, he didn't do a lot of things that people thought he was going to do.
Yeah, I think, you know, at the center of it all was to assure white South Africans in particular, and to also assure blacks that South Africa's problems were going to be negotiated, you know, that there was going to be peace, that the country wasn't going to fall into chaos. I think the problem is that the policies that were since followed resulted in some of the ills we are talking about now. It's quite a problem.
You know, until a number of years ago, when he, you know, firmly withdrew from public life, Mandela was he was sort of the final arbiter, right? If there were labor union problems or political problems or any other problems, people turned to Mandela, and he blessed one side or the other. Will his absence now be destabilizing, in a sense, economically?
I doubt. You know, there wasn't much movement in the markets, for example. Huh. I think at this time, South Africans are pretty much concerned that they should show a degree of respect for Mandela. But I think it's up to the leadership of the country to try and convey that in the most meaningful way and most sincerely, to make sure that South Africans actually live out or live up to Mandela's reconciliatory stance on politics.
Buntu Williams for the BBC in Johannesburg. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kyle.
Coming up.
It's not really clear if he has a vision on the project outside of an awesome creative agency, which is a great idea, but it doesn't necessarily make a business model.
Kanye West tries something new, but first, let's do the numbers. There you go, the really happy music. I win this one. The Dow Industrials charged up 1.25% today, 198 points, 16,020. The NASDAQ regained 0.75%, 29 points, 4,062. The S&P 500 pulled in 1.1%, 20 points, ended at 1,805. But the week was mixed. The Dow off 0.4%. The NASDAQ rose a fraction of 1%. The S&P 500 down that same fraction. With confidence in the economy appearing to grow, financial firms rallied. Goldman Sachs advanced 1%. Bank of America ticked up 0.8%. Ditto for Morgan Stanley. Shares in Barnes & Noble and JCPenney both slid after reports that the companies were being looked at by the SEC. Penny's off nearly 9%. Barnes & Noble booked a 12% loss. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. Are you a member of the Hot Stove League? Because reps from major and minor league teams gather in Orlando, Florida for the 112th Baseball Winter Meetings. It's the United Nations International Anti-Corruption Day, and December 9th is Christmas Card Day. My hand hurts just thinking about it. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Apple basically put its Salesforce right in your pocket today. If you're in an Apple store with the new iBeacon app turned on, you could get a message saying, in essence, hey, I see you're standing in front of the new iPad. You want to upgrade? Let me see if I can get you a discount on that, all right? And if you want to just tap the screen right here, you could walk out with it right now. What do you say? So what do you say? Is that convenient or is it creepy? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the story.
We've mostly gotten used to geolocation. That's the tech that lets you ask your phone, where's the nearest gas station? Of course, it also lets the government ask your phone company, where was Dan Weissman yesterday at 2 p.m.? This is microlocation. iBeacon uses Bluetooth to pinpoint where you are in the Apple store. Other stores like Macy's say they're going to use it too. Attorney Jennifer Lynch monitors privacy issues with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and she says iBeacon could actually be an upgrade from what we've seen before.
At least for this one, the user knows that the app is downloaded onto the phone. There are other types of location tracking systems that stores use where the user has no idea.
Do we care? Catherine Zekier from the Pew Research Center has done surveys. She says about a third of adults say they've turned off geolocation services on their phones, at least sometimes. Yeah, people get a little concerned about how much this data companies keep.
But really, people tend to be more concerned about personal threats, like hackers.
But there's another anxiety here. When Apple shows me a deal, is it as good as the one you're getting? Harvard professor Ben Edelman studies online commerce and advertising.
There's no particular guarantee in the long run that we'll have a world of posted prices, where everyone walks into the store, sees the same price on a paper label on the shelf.
We're used to that kind of discrepancy with, say, airfares.
In the retail context, though, you sort of feel like that can of soup on the shelf should be the same price for everyone.
Because who wants to worry about overpaying for Apple products or applesauce? In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Hundreds of healthcare policy types gathered in Washington, D.C. today, not as you might reasonably expect to talk about problems with healthcare.gov. There was actually another source of confusion, specifically what it means to be in the hospital. As millions of Medicare patients may soon learn, the answer can be surprising and expensive. From the health desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
Carol Levine is an advocate with the nonprofit United Hospital Fund and spoke in Washington today. She told the story of a woman on Medicare who went to the ER after a bad fall. Doctors, says Levine, couldn't really tell her if it was safe for the woman to go home, so they kept her for observation.
And she was brought to a regular floor. She was given an x-ray and blood work. When it was mealtime, she was given food.
But even though the woman was in the hospital for two nights, she was never officially admitted. She was considered an outpatient, and outpatients are responsible for costs that inpatients aren't. That includes the cost for rehab after the woman's fall.
They would have billed her as a private patient. It would have cost tens of thousands of dollars.
Keeping patients for observation has more than doubled from 2001 to 2009. Keith Lind is with the AARP.
Medicare recommends that observation be used usually for less than 24 hours, but we found that length of stay exceeding 48 hours had grown by more than 250%.
The hospitals are not doing this to inconvenience patients. They're trying to make things work financially for themselves.
That's Dan Mendelson, the CEO of Avalere Health. Under the Affordable Care Act, hospitals are being slapped with fines for readmissions. But when you don't admit a patient, you can't be penalized. Mendelson says the policy is intended to lower costs and improve care, but what it may do instead is shift the cost to the patient. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Five years ago this coming Wednesday, we all learned the name Bernie Madoff. His arrest that day brought to light the biggest financial fraud this country has ever seen. Mr. Madoff is now a long-term guest of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, but Sally Herships went out and checked in with some of his victims.
If you want to feel like a real jerk, try calling up nice little old Jewish ladies and men and asking them to tell you about losing all their money to Bernie Madoff. No one wants to talk about having their life savings sucked away by a con artist. But Joyce Greenberg wasn't so wary.
Did you check on me before we scheduled our interview?
No, I can't Google because I don't use a computer.
So you haven't lost all your trust?
Well, not completely, just when it comes to managing money.
Greenberg lives in Houston. Years earlier, her father had opened college funds for her two daughters, and she says they'd done well. So when she needed someone to manage her own investments, she called the manager her dad had used. His name was Bernie Madoff. She knows how the complicated world of finance is supposed to work because she used to be a stockbroker.
This is a Bernard L. Madoff investment securities confirmation. It says a member of FINRA, NSX, SIPC. These are all fiction, but there's no way of knowing. It looks absolutely like a genuine confirmation.
Greenberg says one of her daughters lost her nest egg and had to get a second job, and she herself lost a substantial amount. But Greenberg is part of a small group who qualify for restitution. She says she got back a little over 10%. And because she thought the money was gone anyway, she gave it to her alma mater, $2 million to the University of Chicago.
Do you feel like that this situation then in your life has actually had a positive effect in some way?
It teaches me not to let anybody else invest my money.
Greenberg says now her investments are doing better than Madoff's fictional ones ever did. But most of his victims have not been as lucky. The only others who would talk to me were a mother and son, Michael and Emma DeVita.
It changes the way you live. It changes the way you think. You think twice before you spend a dollar and say, do I really need this? And can I find it cheaper on the internet?
Emma DeVita is in her 80s and Michael is in his 60s. They live in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. Michael DeVita heard about Madoff from a guy on his softball team. When his dad passed away back in 2008, the plan was for his mom to withdraw her Madoff money to live on.
And on, you'll love this, December 8th of 2008, we were sitting in our local bank signing the paperwork to close the accounts and move it into super secure CDs.
Oh, 3 days before he was arrested.
3 days before he was arrested.
You would think they got their money out just in time, but because it was part of a fraud, the money is gone. Michael DeVita was supposed to retire 5 years ago.
Well, I never retired, so I'm just going to stay working.
DeVita says now he's on a crusade. He teaches a class on the whole debacle at a local college, and he's written a book, 65 Billion Reasons Why You Cannot Trust Wall Street. But the DeVitas say they also feel betrayed by the government. When you earn interest on an investment, you pay taxes on that interest. Michael DeVita says the interest he earned from his investment with Madoff never really existed, and so he wants his tax dollars back again. And his mom agrees.
And it's to no avail. The government will not pass the law to refund the income tax to us that we paid on that money, and they are the biggest winners. And it's just not fair.
I asked an IRS spokesperson about the DeVita's complaint, but he said the IRS can't discuss specific cases. Michael DeVita served in the Navy and said many of his family members have also enlisted. He and his mom feel like their patriotism hasn't been repaid.
And I had a hard time getting over that. And now I've accepted it. And you don't think back of what was, you look at what is. And that's the way you live.
Emma DeVita wanted me to know other Madoff victims are worse off. And she says she has the things that are necessary to live, like friends and family. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Kanye West has a new gig he's trying to get going. Not music so much, but what's being called a creative agency, the definition of which he has been kind of vague about. He's been trying to get venture capital money from people in Silicon Valley, which has not been working out so well for him. LaToya Peterson is the founder and editor of Racialicious.com. It's a site that covers pop culture and race. LaToya, good to have you with us.
Hey, happy to be here.
Why is Kanye not getting any love on this thing? Why don't VCs want to invest in him?
Well, you know, the problem is that Kanye's reputation has preceded him on a lot of his projects, right? He is a visionary. He is a great mind. But at the same time, he is notoriously difficult to work with. And it's not really clear if he has a vision on the project for Donda outside of an awesome creative agency, which is a great idea, but it doesn't necessarily make a business model.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to read you a quote of his and get your take on this one. He said, like, whatever idea I have, I want to bring it to fruition. Willy Wonka didn't stop making chocolate because he was making other things. So clearly the inference is he can do lots and make music, but what is that lots, right?
Yeah, and the other problem is that I think that a lot of celebrities in general, this is not just a Kanye problem, tend to overreach a bit, and they assume that because they were good or talented at this one part of society, this one section, that will automatically transfer to everything else. Like, it's like a celebrity Midas touch.
How much of a factor will it be that, you know, Kanye is a black guy in the music industry trying to talk to mostly white guys in the tech industry to get some money?
You know, it's interesting because race is definitely playing a role with this, but I think it's more in how people perceive his attitude, right? Hmm. So if Kanye was, say, more of a Zuckerberg type, right? Yeah. Young white guy, just dropped out of Harvard, was like, I had the best idea on the planet. I feel like he'd be received better in Silicon Valley than he is for his persona as a brash musician. I think there's still a lot of racial coding with that. At the same time, though, he doesn't really have a track record in Silicon Valley, and it's not as if other rappers haven't tried to go there, like MC Hammer and Chamillionaire are trying to make a presence for themselves in Silicon Valley. So it's not unheard of that people are going through and trying to invest and doing other things. It's just a little weird for Kanye to suddenly pivot and say, this is where I want to be.
This kind of goes to a balance sheet question that we might not have the answer to, but why does Kanye need VC investment? Why does he need tech investment? Can't he just bootstrap this thing? Isn't he doing well enough?
So there's been this really interesting shift online where Kanye is trying to almost build legitimacy in these different places, right? Like, notice that Kanye has not done the typical rapper's guide to fashion, like the way that Rockaware and Baby Fat they went for mass market retailers. They wanted to be in Nordstrom. They wanted to be accessible to people on the streets. Kanye was like, no, I want to be high fashion. I want to premiere at Fashion Week. Like, for him, it's really about image and it's about mainstream credibility. And so for him, yeah, he could invest. He could open his creative agency with the money that he has, probably that he blows on, you know, Cristal or whatever they're drinking nowadays. I don't know. I'm getting old. But, you know, whatever you spend in the club, right? Yeah. He can open the agency on that. But it's more important for him to have that buy-in from what he sees as power players.
Right.
And it's, you know, just one of those things that continually haunts him, his quest for legitimacy and his quest to be kind of at the forefront of all fields. So to him, I think that investing his own money would almost be like a failure to him because he couldn't get the buy-in from the players that he wanted to.
LaToya Peterson, she runs a website called racialicious.com. LaToya, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we catch a glimpse of the future, electronic money has been used to buy an electronic car. The Lamborghini dealership in Newport Beach, right here in Southern California, announced this week that somebody came in and bought a Tesla using bitcoins. Sticker price on a Tesla S Performance is about $95,000, plus or minus. At today's rate of exchange, it's about 108 bitcoins, although it is worth a note that bitcoins have lost 30% of their value in just the past 2 days, so there is that. And with that, we're out of here. That is Marketplace from APM on this Friday. Today, the Dow up 1.25%, about 198 points on the job number. The NASDAQ regained 0.75%, 29 points. The S&P 500 pulled in 1.1%, 20 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I am back on Monday sounding better. My name is Kai Rizdahl, but you know that. See ya. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.